It is a great pleasure to welcome to European Investing Summit 2023, returning MOI Global instructor Santiago Domingo, an investment analyst at Magallanes Value Investors. Magallanes is an independent equity-only asset management firm following value investment philosophy and controlled by its founders. The aim is to preserve and increase clients' capital by outperforming the market in the long term. Previously, Santiago worked as an equity portfolio manager for Solventis Asset Management, as an analyst for a startup called Oral Surgery Tube, and in Endesa's finance department. Santiago holds a bachelor's degree in finance and accounting from University of Zaragoza, and a master's degree in institutions and financial markets from CUNEF. He's a CFA charter holder. Always great to have you with us, Santiago. I very much look forward to your presentation and would now like to turn it to you. Please go ahead.
Thank you very much, John, for the introduction. It's always a pleasure to be here with you. I think, I don't know if it's my fifth or even sixth edition, so it's always great to contribute to this good event, this good summit that present some interesting ideas. So I hope you enjoy the idea that we present today. As John mentioned, just to talk a little bit about us, about Magallanes Value Investors, we are an equity long-only asset management firm based here in Madrid, founded almost 9 years ago. We are totally independent. This allows us to be coherent with what we think. We can act in the way we think, and that's crucial. For investment, we think we are co-invested in our funds. Obviously, all the employees have a good chunk of their savings here, and obviously the founders. We have a family business culture. We have a very optimized team. We are around 15 people within Magallanes, and around 5 people in the investment team. So what we try to do is to maintain this family culture business, culture in the firm, but also in the companies that we look for. And Antofagasta is an example. We have assets under management around 2.5 billion euros, and almost 90% is in the European equity strategy. Iberian equities are around this 10% or a bit less, and microcaps is less than 5%. Microcaps is a closed fund that we have, where we invest in very, very small companies here in Europe, and where we have assets under management around 100 million, and it's already closed. We do all of this following a value investing philosophy, because we think it's the best investment style to not only get good returns, but to outperform over the long run. Because at the end of the day, as you can see in this slide, our aim is to preserve and after increase the capital over the long run. And I always repeat the same: first to preserve, second to increase, because it's important to survive in any kind of environment, in the darkest days as well. So for us, it's quite important to be not only invested in cheap companies as we are, but also in companies with a strong balance sheet, with good management teams, with family or reference holder, if it's possible, and with businesses that we can understand they will survive over time. So The company that we bring to you today is Antofagasta. A few years ago, we presented Atalaya Mining. That's another copper mining company. We could say that Atalaya is the small child that we have in our in our microcap portfolio, and Antofagasta is the big child that we have in our European fund, or both of them related to copper mining. In the case of Antofagasta, and just at a glance, and afterwards we will deepen a bit more in the copper market dynamics and in Antofagasta itself. What I would like to highlight is this is a Chilean copper company that produces more than 650,000 of tons of copper per year. This represents around 2.5% of market share. We will later see that the supply and demand is almost balancing in the copper market right now. It's a low mid cost producer. Has some of the best mines in the world, especially Los Pelambres. That is one of the four mines that they have. They have a very strong balance sheet with almost net cash. That's so important for us because it gives us a lot of comfort in the worst time. Because at the end of the day, we should be aware that investing in mining is investing in cyclicality. So we have to have a very strong balance sheet in order to survive over bad periods of time. And all of this is backed by the Luksic family, one of the most, if not the most prominent family in terms of business in Chile. They own more than 60%, almost 65% of the company. They have other investments also in Hapag-Lloyd and other businesses. Their net worth is calculated to be more than $20 billion. So you can imagine that's a well respected and well known family. So once we have in our mind more or less the size of Antofagasta, who is behind Antofagasta, and what are the very basics of Antofagasta, we think it's very important in any company, but especially in the mining space, to understand the underlying. In this case, the underlying is clear, is copper. When we talk about copper, what we have to do is to understand the dynamics. Talking about mining, I would say there are two keys, supply and demand. And with these two keys, with these two ingredients, we have the outcome, that is the price, in this case, copper price. This is a path that we are going to follow in order to understand why we think the copper price should be higher over the long term compared to the current market price. The first thing is so easy and so understandable. If you want almost anything, you need copper. For me, this image is very clear. You see this mine and you see these applications. Sometimes people or some governments want the application, but that doesn't want the mine. But this does not match. You need both things. You need the technology behind these applications, but also you need the copper that is extracted from these mines. Because the difference between a world with or without copper is darkness. If we don't have copper, we probably wouldn't have most of the things that are around us. So probably, we will take later on about green transition, electric vehicle, renewables, wind, solar, and so on. If we believe in this transition, we can talk about the path of the transition. We are talking about a new king on the commodity space. And this is, I think, probably copper. Because copper has very good properties and applications. First of all, it's the best non-precious metal conductor of electricity. In fact, around 75% of copper is used for electrical purposes. Only silver, that is much more expensive than copper, has better electrical purposes. And also copper is better electrical conductor than aluminium. That would be, how to say, the the cheaper option compared to copper. Secondly, it's a very malleable and ductile ductile metal, because you can do very thin sheets. You can do very very different things with the copper in order to adapt to your needs. Also, it's a very resilient material because it can last more than 100 years, and it's a very easy recyclable metal. Because at the end of the day, due to this resilience, you can preserve most of the properties, even though you recycle the copper several times. And this property was more important during COVID-19, but obviously it's also important now. It has a very important antimicrobial property that allows you to eliminate some diseases or the spread of some diseases. So you can use it with multiple purposes, like pipes, surfaces, paints, towels, or whatever. Once we understood that copper, it's a very useful material, very well used in the current society, let's take a look to these two keys, these two ingredients that we talked before. First of all, we have demand. Currently, the copper demand is around 25 million tons. More than one half is done by China. And if we add the rest of Asia, we could say that around 65%, 75% of the demand of copper comes from Asia, because at the end of the day is where most of the growth it is right now. So this is important because at the end of the day, it's an opportunity and it's a risk, because if we see a China slowdown, or if we are seeing a Chinese slowdown, we can say, okay, we are going to consume less copper. But when we talk about a Chinese slowdown, we are not macro analysts. We are talking about reducing the growth from 5% or 6%, depending on the year, to 4%. So this is growth. And if you take a look to the copper demand in China, you see how it is growing. So under normal circumstances, we should expect that copper demand grows around 2 to 3% per year. Without taking into account this green transition, this renovation cycle, and all these megatrends that we are going to talk right now. Because if we take into account these megatrends, this number could go to 4-5% per year. So this would mean that the copper demand should add around 500 to 750,000 of tons of copper per year. If we take into account the megatrends, we could talk about more than 1 million tons per year. This is more than one Antofagasta per year. Believe me, this is almost impossible based on the supply visibility that we have right now. And we will take later on to open a copper mine. Is not only not easy in terms of getting the permits, especially in some developed countries. It's very complicated from a technical point of view, and it's very complicated in terms of a time point of view, because it usually takes more than 10 years or around 10 years from the discovery of a mine to the operation of a mine, with many, many delays in this period of time. So what I would like to share with you is that more or less we can affirm that we have the demand, or the copper demand, for sure for the long term, and for sure growing around 3 to 4% per year, because we have all these megatrends. And for us, when we see these megatrends, we don't want only to take a look to the name and to say, oh, okay, electric vehicle, renewable energy. No, what we want is to mix, as Professor Damodaram says, narrative and numbers. So what we like to do is, okay, let's put numbers to this green transition. And if we put numbers to this green transition, what we see is, first, an EV vehicle needs between 2 to 4 times more copper than an internal combustion engines. This means that if normally, or probably the next year, around 90 million cars or vehicles are going to be sold in the world, and we assume that, I don't know, in 10 years, 15 years, 20 years, I don't mind the time because it's going to come, a half of that cars are going to be electric. We will probably need around 2 million tons more per year of copper. This is huge. This is around 7 to 8% of the current production and of the current demand. So it would suppose a huge increase on the needs of copper. The same for renewable energy. When we talk about wind, we talk about solar, we have to be aware that these technologies are between 30 to 40 more copper intensive than generating electrical energy by burning coal or other methods. The same for the storage. To have a storage of electricity, you also, for energy, you need copper. And for renovation, we have here in Europe a trend of renovation in order to be more efficient. And to be more efficient means to need more copper. So it's also another trend. And not to talk about something that has been shown over the history, that it's the copper intensity, the copper intensity or installed copper base per capita. What this means is that normally those countries with the lowest GDP per capita have a lower copper installed base. For instance, these poor countries, we can say in that way, consumes around one or half 100 pounds of copper per capita installed. In the case of the rich countries, in the case of those countries with the higher GDP per capita, they have around 500 pounds, sorry, of copper per person per capita. So what we see here is that if all these countries that are following their developing cycle, we could talk about India, we could talk about other African countries like Nigeria, we could talk about other Asian countries apart from China, obviously, should consume more copper. Why? Because the needs of the population, the needs of infrastructure, the needs of development requires more copper. So for us, the demand is not a problem, because this is something that I want you to have in mind, is that normally copper demand drives the sentiment. I mean, drives the short term of copper price. Because if you see, when you talk about, or when you see that some broker reduces the outlook for copper price, he or they usually say, okay, less copper is going to be needed this year because China is slowing down, because, I don't know, India is not going well or whatever. They don't talk about supply. They don't talk, okay, it's because less and less mines are putting on the ground. It's always about demand. And this short term is always about demand. But when we take a look to the long term, and this is something that is common for most of the metals, except for gold, that special one, is driven by supply. It's driven by supply because at the end of the day, what we see in the case of copper and other metals is a permanent underinvestment over the recent decades. And we will talk later on some of the reasons. So if you want to take a look to the copper price and you want to analyze the copper price over the long term, if you want to look at the real fundamentals, please look at the supply. Because in this case, demand is more or less something sure. It will grow 2, 3, 4, I don't know. But at the end of the day, this growth is warranted because this growth depends on the economic progress of the world. So looking at the supply, what we see is that it's so similar to the copper demand, around these 25 million tons between mining and scrap copper. Most of it, around 22 million, it comes from production in mines, and 3 million from scrap copper. What we see is it's very concentrated in Chile and Peru, around 40% more or less of the production. Here you have some of the biggest companies in the copper space. Are Codelco, are Freeport-McMoRan, Glencore, BHP, Antofagasta. And what you see is that this production is very concentrated in one, two countries. And this is also another risk, because what we have seen is how also some political developments have burdened the increase in the production in some of these countries. You also have Congo that's growing a lot, but and they have very good mines with very good ore grades, but it's also, you have some kind of political instability that in the short term it's okay, but over the long term can cause huge damages, and even more if you look at the long term, and if you look at Congo representing more and more in this copper production pie, we can say in that way. And here, another thing is not only about the regions where copper is produced, it's about the disruptions. Always, all the years, you have some kind of disruption in the production of copper. And it's not small, it's around 4% more or less, that is around 1 million tons per year. Due to strikes, due to weather, due to delay problems, due to political issues, due to closures, I mean, due to many, many, many things. So this is another thing that we should take into account, because disruptions are the norm rather than deception. And looking at the supply, apart from the disruptions, there are other challenges. These are more important. Over the long term, declining ore rates. As I mentioned before, the best-in-class mines have already been discovered. Most of them have already been extracted the most prominent or the best ore rates, with the exception of some African countries. The new discoveries are in remote places that usually lack of infrastructure. Imagine that mines are not on our side, on our street. They are in Los Andes. They are in the middle of nowhere. They are in some places of Africa where you don't have even the electrical grid or the energy grid that you need. Some of them are underground, that are much costlier to exploit. And you have also some water supply issues, even more in the current climate change environment. This is something that it's affecting to Antofagasta. The water supply, it's scarce in some Chilean regions. They are doing, or they're investing in desalination plants that are key for the future. And also from a financing point of view, almost nobody but a few banks want to finance this kind of assets. All of these banks want to finance technological investments or whatever, but all this technological investment that needs copper to be run, nobody or almost nobody wants to finance those copper investments. So it's something that is weird, but at the end of the day, it's how the world works. And you have also the social pressure. Nobody wants to have a mine in front of the street, but because at the end of the day, it generates some pollution. It also generates other social things. But what you should take a look is how rich are the places, usually the places where you have these mines well run. Here in Spain, for instance, I talked before about Atalaya. We have the Rio Tinto mine in the south of Spain. Probably this town, Rio Tinto, and the towns around there are one of the richest of the region, because mining, well-developed mining, generate a lot of wealth among the people that live there, because they pay good wages, they give you good security, they give you, how to say, welfare. So usually all these things are good, but at first sight, people usually say, okay, I don't want this close to me. So all in all, with all these challenges, what we have seen over the last years, it's a huge underinvestment in the copper mining space. And once again, let's take a look to the numbers. And it's what shows to us. If you take a look to this graph and look at the global copper growth capex, you see how it is declining year over year. This means that less and less and less companies are interested in investing. Why? Because either the price is high enough, because they don't find the right places to do it. They don't find comfortable with some governments. They don't like some regulations. They don't like some taxes. They get problems to get financing. So it's not easy. It's not only to find the deposit that's complicated. It's to being able to develop it. And it's not an easy task. And this, if we add to this the inventory situation, we have been living over the last years in a very, very low inventory situation. You can see in this graph how it has evolved from June 2018 to almost now. It's true that it's increasing a bit recently, probably due to the slowdown that we are seeing in some parts of the economy, but in any case, it's below average. And something that we should add to this supply equation is the depletion rate. I mean, you have all these mines that normally, if you don't invest nothing, reduces the production around 2 to 3% per year. This is another almost not 1 million, but a few thousand tons of copper that you need due to this depletion rate year after year. So at the end of the day, what we see is that the needs of copper are increasing, but the supply is not able to match this demand needs. And what you need to incentivize more investment is a higher incentive price. Because as we see in the following graph, and I presented this already in the past, is that over the years, the capex per project, the capex per ton, usually increases. It began in the 90s being around $10,000 per ton. And currently, we are seeing some projects that are needing around $30,000 per ton. And why is this? Because all the previous reason, because you have to go to remote places that you want to install in new infrastructure, you have to get permits, you have more complicated to get access to water, to financing, and all of these things, what usually does is to increase the cost of opening a mine. And if this increases, you have to require a higher copper price. Because of that, the current copper price is not enough to incentivize the supply, sorry. And if incentive price is not high enough, we have copper deficit. And this is the result of all the previous things that we have seen. Demand is growing, as you see here again. Copper projects are not enough to match the demand. The current mines are getting older, so they are also seeing some depletion rate. And if we don't invest quickly, we are going to have a huge deficit over the long term. The deficit is almost secure over the coming years, probably from 2025 onwards, if the demand keeps growing. But we can solve in some way if we begin to invest. But it seems that most of the companies are interested in doing that, but with a better terms, a better conditions, than those that are offered currently by governments, by regulation, and by the copper price itself. And here, what I would like to highlight, or I would like to sum up, is that copper price should be above $4 to $5 probably dollars per pound in order to be interesting for the companies to invest in new mines, because as I mentioned before, to open a mine is getting costlier year after year. currently, due to have a copper price in your mind, it's around $3.5 per pound. So to talk about or to think about some investments, we should see an increase in copper price at least of around 25%, more or less. And not only that, is to have visibility that for the coming years, 20 to 25 years, you are going to have high copper prices. Well, once we understood why copper is necessary, why there is not enough copper for the demand, and why the copper price should be higher, let's take a look to Antofagasta. Because at the end of the day, when you have a clear idea of what commodity should do over the future, what you have to do is to look for the vehicle to invest in the, how to say, most proper way in this trend. In this case, we think Antofagasta is one of the best, if not the best, copper mining in the world, because they have four assets. This eliminates to you one risk, that is the monomine risk. So you have four. One of them, along probably Los Pelambres and Centinela, are two of the best copper mines in the world. As you can see, they don't have 100% in all of them. In most of them, they have a partner, normally a Japanese partner, like Marubeni in the case of Centinela, or in the case in Zaldívar, that's a joint venture, you have Barrick along with Antofagasta. So in this case, first talking about Los Pelambres, what we see, it's a mine that produces more than 300,000 tons per year. That puts Los Pelambres in the top quartile of most important companies in terms of production. It has a life of mine of around 12 years. This is important to have in mind, that this life of mine is not something that once you get these 12 years, you have to close the mine. Why? Because Antofagasta keeps investing in Los Pelambres, in deposits around Los Pelambres, in order to maintain or increase this life of mine. So what I mean with this is that if we do this presentation in 5 years, 10 years, the life of mine is not going to be two. Probably it's going to be 10, 12, 14, because they are able to maintain this investing money around the mine. The ore rate is quite good. It's around 0.6%, and the net cash cost is so good as well, because it's one of the lowest cost, producer mine or copper mine in the world. They also get some byproducts like gold and molybdenum. In the case of Centinela, this is another huge mine with more than 200,000 tons of copper production. The life of mine is much much higher. The ore rate is good, around 0.4, and is also a very low cash cost copper mine producer. In the case of Antucoya, here what you have is a good life of mine. The ore rate is a bit lower, so when you have a lower ore rate, what you have to do is to adjust as much as you can your costs in order to be efficient and to be profitable, to extract the metal, in this case copper, and in this case you don't have any byproduct. And finally, in the case of Zaldívar, this is a joint venture. The proportionate share of the production of Antofagasta in Zaldívar is around these 50,000 tons of copper. The life of mine is also more than 10 years. They have here a permit that should be extended over the coming years. The ore grade is here. It's around this 0.4%. But it's true that it's not as efficient as the others. One of the reasons is because the size is smaller than the others, and probably because the best part we can say of the mine has been already extracted, and they have to dig deeper, and this is usually more costlier for the company. And the good thing of Antofagasta is that they have room to grow. They can they can increase their production. They have some expansions like Los Pelambres expansion that's on track right now, along with some decisions that have to be made probably over the end of this year, the coming year, about Centinela concentrator, also about more expansion in Los Pelambres. And looking at the very long term, they have this Encierro and Cachorro deposits that could be also be very important for the long term and could add a few thousand tons of copper. With all of this, you could reach this 900,000 tons of copper per year. In our estimations, we don't take into account this growth. As you can imagine, we are very, very conservative, so we prefer to base our decisions in what we have right now, assuming the cost that it's supposed to maintain what you have right now, and focusing on understanding the copper price dynamics and understanding also the cost structure that Antofagasta has in order to have the best approximation to the free cash flow that this company could generate. And another important thing here in terms of cost is that when we talk about Antofagasta, we are talking about one low to mid cost producer. This gives us a bit more comfort, because when copper price goes down, and eventually it does, we feel comfortable that Antofagasta is able to be profitable or at least break even in those bad scenarios. At the same time, other companies with higher cost production are suffering more. So this is another layer of security that you add to your investment. On the other side, when copper price goes higher, obviously, you don't take advantage as much as you do when you invest in a high cost producer, because in a high cost producer, the operating leverage is much higher, because an increase in the copper price affects you more in terms of margin. Moreover, in the case of Antofagasta, you almost don't have financial leverage because you are almost net cash. So it's a safe way we think of invest in copper, in the copper mining space. And we do it supporting us in three key pillars. And it's what we mentioned before. One, you have a very, very small net debt, around this 0.5 times net debt to EBITDA. It's managed by a very good management team. Iván Arriagada, the CEO, has been in place since 2016. CFO Mauricio is also there for several years. You have the Luksic family with more than 60% of the share capital, always very committed within the company. They have done a great job here. They always try to preserve this financial strength. They don't make any kind of crazy capital allocation. They don't like to buy things. Recently, the only thing that they bought was this 50% in Zaldívar, and it was, I think, 7 to 8 years ago, paying around $20,000 per ton. That it's a reasonable price. They recently divested Recodic, that's a copper and gold deposit in Pakistan that has to be developed. It has been there for decades, and right now there is a lot of hype around this deposit, but we will see. They prefer to focus on what they know, on what they are. It's mainly in Chile, because they also try to do something in North America, in the USA, but they had many problems. It's called Twin Metals, based in Minnesota, but the Biden administration has put many, many problems to develop any copper mine or almost any mine there. So they focus on the assets that they have to increase the production through brownfields that normally are cheaper too, and to try to extract as much as they can in their current footprint. And talking about numbers, talking about valuation, we have three valuations. The pessimistic one would be a replacement value, but it would be okay. Let's take the production that has Antofagasta right now and try to replace and to build a new Antofagasta. I would say this is almost impossible, because you have many intangibles that are not that are not in these numbers, like getting the permits, like getting the know-how, like getting all the relationship with your clients, with the two suppliers. But if we do this mathematical calculation, what we have, it's around a capex per ton of $25,000 per ton. If we have if we take a number that's very in line with the current market, this would give us around £10 per share, would be the value of Antofagasta, and this would suppose a downside close to 30%. This would be like a base, would be like a floor for us. And this floor usually has been a good buying opportunity, a very good buying opportunity. Currently, we work with a base scenario where we assume a copper price. In this case, we assume this $4 per pound. As I mentioned before, and as I explained before, there are strong reasons to believe that copper price should be higher. We have understood that we are in front of a low mid cost producer, so we are able to calculate that free cash flow, apply a conservative multiples, and get that the upside to be more than 70%, around these £23 per share. And finally, we have the optimistic one that would be to take a copper price much higher, around 4.5, even $5. Per pound, would give us more than 100 upside and more than £30 per share. Any of these scenarios, depending on how conservative or how optimistic you want to be, are reasonable. We prefer to stay in the base one, and if it goes to the pessimistic one, probably we would add some more shares as we did in the past. All in all, just to finish Antofagasta. First of all, Antofagasta is based in Chile. They have all their assets there. So we are in front of a stable legal regulation. So this is very important. It's very important to know what are the rules under which you are going to do your businesses. It's true that Chile has been a bit turbulent over the recent years, mainly due to a new constitution that should be voted over the end of this year, because it was rejected the last year. They changed a bit the tax regime, has been a bit worse for Antofagasta and the rest of copper miners. Remind that I think copper, it's, I don't know, 10% of exports or 10% of GDP of Chile. It's a very important industry. But even though we think Chile is a very reliable place to be. Secondly, Antofagasta is a producer. This is very, very important. They have four producing assets, because a producer companies are based on realities. You can touch that copper. You can touch that mining. But junior companies are based on dreams. Miners tend to be too optimistic, but there is always more problems than expected in terms of cost, in terms of delay, in terms of many things. So it's safer to invest in something that is real, that invest in something that it's a dream, that perhaps in a few years is going to become into a producing asset, but right now it isn't. To do it with experienced management, people that has worked in this space for many years, if you can, and they are mining engineers, is better, because they know the how to say the assets, because this is a kind of business where finance is not enough. You need to know how evolves the demand of these kind of assets. You have to know almost every deposit that is around the world in order to understand the supply. You have to learn how inventories move depending on the cycle. So you have to have a good touch, a good knowledge of the market where you are, not only about the numbers, but also about these all other things. In this case, Antofagasta has also a strong balance sheet. It's very important to survive in the darkest days. And it's also very, very cheap looking at the medium term. And this is something that is going to sound you a bit counterintuitive, but normally these assets has to be bought when the multiples are high and to be sold when the multiples are low. Because the mining companies are very, very cyclical. So in the worst times in terms of share price performance are those where you get the worst results. And if you get the worst results, this means that you get the high multiples. It's the moment to buy these companies. When you see that all is going well, they are generating a lot of free cash flow, they are generating chunks of EBITDA, please take a look and check if you think the current prices of the metal is sustainable, because normally markets, and especially in cyclical companies, and especially in very cyclical companies as mining companies, tends to overshoot on the upside, and also it tends to go very, very deep in the downside. And finally, just to share something that I did several times, a book, The Sipping Man. I think it's a real good way to deepen and to dig into the in this case of in the sipping space, but also in the kinds of a cyclical sector like sipping that has some common things with copper. A serious band of brothers. I love the unity of these heroes that had to do some things in the past that were not probably the what they wanted, but they had to do it. But they saw how the unity, the humility, the humble way of doing these things give them or give the path to get the victory. And finally, a phrase, a sentence that for me is the key, one of the keys in investing, is that the hardest thing to learn in life is which bridge to cross and which to burn. In this business, you have to say many, many times no. This is something that Munger says many, many times, and eventually you say yes. And in this case, we said yes to Antofagasta a few years ago, and we keep invested in Antofagasta, and we think it's a good investment looking at the future. So thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Santiago. Really appreciate this presentation. In terms of the valuation of a copper company in general and this company specifically, does it make sense to also look at reserves and some kind of I guess how much we are paying per pound of reserves or something like that?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's another conservative way of doing this. I would say that the most conservative way would be resources and reserves. In this case, what you have to take into account is what kind of reserves or resources are. Because there are several times, there are several types, sorry, are inferred resources, are proven or provable reserves. And all of this depends on the kind of research or investigation or the holes that you have done on the ground in order to know if you have copper or not. If you have done only one hole on the ground and you say here you are going to have copper, probably this is not a reserve, this is a potential resource. Okay, if you have done many holes and you have done all the geological work, you could say, okay, we have here a reserve. And once you get, if this is a resource, this is a reserve, and what kind of resource or reserve it is, you have to apply the copper price that you think is a correct copper price, and to apply a multiple, because you have the copper on the ground. Afterwards, you have to build all the infrastructure to extract that copper. So usually, depending on the grade of security that you have, that there is copper there, you apply a more conservative multiple or a less conservative multiples. This multiple can go from 1% of copper price multiplied by the reserves or whatever to 10% of the copper price multiplied by that. But absolutely, it's a good measure, a very conservative measure. We did it in Antofagasta and we did it in Atalaya. In the case of Antofagasta, would represent another floor of valuation, because at the end of the day, it's a producing company. So you have to take into account that the irons, we can say the machines and infrastructure that they have has a value, not only the reserves that that they have, but absolutely it's also a good way of value a mining company, a copper too.
And in your experience, just to follow up on that, what's kind of a generally attractive multiple, if copper prices are around four or something like that, like paying 1/10 of that, maybe 30, 40 cents per pound of reserves?
Yeah, it depends. I would say that the highest quality reserve in mining, I would pay around 1/10, 10% of the copper price multiplied by the reserves in terms of copper that I would have. In the lowest end, in those that I only did a hole, we can say in that way that are resources and are inferred resources because I did a hole and I made a lot of assumptions that based on the hole that I did, I should have around me X and tons of copper. I would apply 1% of copper price or even less. And this is very important, John, because many times junior companies say, okay, I have tons of reserves here. Okay, you should stop and say, okay, what kind of reserves? What kind of resources? Okay, where they are located? Okay, what byproduct you have with all of that? Okay, are easy to extract. I mean, there are a lot of questions to do even before thinking about the point on the, how to say, on the permits to get where you are. The first thing would be to know well what kind of reserves or resources are underground. And afterwards, let's take a look on how you are going to extract. But first of all, okay, be sure that what they are showing to you in the numbers is fine. And many times it is, but you have to do those checks.
Okay, makes sense. Do you like to see some kind of a dividend yield from a miner, to just sort of, demonstrate some commitment to shareholders or mm-hmm. some discipline on the management?
Yeah, I think in the case of mining companies, it depends from company to company. In the case of Antofagasta, they have been investing a lot in the desalinization plan in Los Pelambres. They are also investing in some expansions. They are investing in new resources that they are getting. So for me, organic growth would be the first and most important way of allocate capital. Because at the end of the day, it's not only about maintaining your current production, but also if you could expand that production at correct or the right prices, it's great. Because it's something in the case of us that we believe in, that is the copper price that should be higher. We believe in the way of Antofagasta is doing things. So we think it's the best way of allocate our money. Obviously, if it's allocated in the proper way. Afterwards, in the current scenario, probably I would prefer a share buyback than a dividend, because probably it's most accretive over the long term than a dividend right now. And third, and also very important, is leverage. In the case of Antofagasta, I am very, very comfortable with the leverage because it's so small. But in any mining company, what I would require to that mining company is to have a conservative leverage. Probably 0.5 times would be very conservative for somebody. But I don't like those mining companies that are 2, 3, 4 times net debt to EBITDA. But also take into account in which point of the cycle we are. If you have 2.2 times, for instance, in the low point of the cycle where copper price is down, it's okay. But if you have, for instance, 3-4 times in the peak of the cycle and you do M&As and you do all those kind of things, would be very, very scary for me and this company, even more if they distribute a dividend. And in this case, I am very, very comfortable with the management, because at the end of the day, you have Luksic family looking obviously very carefully to the asset as well. And you have a very experienced management team, well aligned in terms of incentives with the company. So we are pretty comfortable, and we don't need a high dividend to show us that there is discipline in them.
Right, makes sense. You know, given your bullish view on copper long term, would you also consider investing in a higher cost producer? As you said, there's greater operating leverage in that case. Is there any company that you like that maybe at current copper prices isn't very profitable, but could become, you know, very profitable if copper prices go higher?
Yeah, in this case, we have one. That's Atalaya Mining. I presented, I think, in European Investing Summit 2020. It's a mid-high cost producer, because at the end of the day, first is based on Spain. That's a higher cost environment. Secondly, it's a deposit that was discovered, I think, more than 100 years ago. So it's the best ore rate has been already extracted. So when you take a look to the cost here, it's also quite important to remind to all of you that there are different kind of cash costs. When a mining company talks to you about a cash cost, you have to look at what are they taking into account. Because of that, we usually like to take to the all-in sustaining cash cost. For all of you is fully included. I mean, it's all included there. So in this case, Antofagasta is around this $2 per pound. Probably it's a bit higher right now due to the inflation. But if we take a look to this number in the case of Atalaya, for instance, we are talking above $3 per pound. That with $3.5 per pound of copper price, and you should add some kind of discount because you sell this copper concentrate to a smelter that only pays to you 95% of the copper price, the money that you get is thin. So this is one example of company in the case of Atalaya that is a mid-high cost producer, but we feel comfortable. Why? Because we know that we have this operating leverage. We know that in the current scenario, we are break even or making a few euros. That we know that if copper price goes down, and it could do it, we are going to lose money, but we don't have financial leverage, John. This, we have only one booster, that it's operating leverage, but we are no financial leverage because we have a company with also net cash, in this case, Atalaya Mining. So we have the safety cushion to know that if things go wrong and the copper price is down for several months or quarter, this company is going able to survive, is going able to adapt the cost structure, and is going able to flourish over the long term. So what I wouldn't do is to invest in a mining company with the two boosters, we can say, that it's operating and financial leverage. Operating leverage, okay, it's assumable, but financial leverage is not for us in mining space. And believe me, there are many, many companies in the mining space that not only have this operating leverage, but also the financial leverage. And this is real complicated if you have low metal, in this case, copper, low copper prices for a long time.
Makes sense. Thank you so much, Santiago. I would just encourage MOI Global members to feel free to follow up with any further thoughts or questions. Great pleasure to have you with us. Thank you for taking the time to share this investment thesis with the MOI Global community.
Thank you so much, Ian. Have a nice day, and I hope you like our presentation.
Thank you. Best wishes. Goodbye for now.